Thank you, Rabbi Goldman, the dear friend and respected and admired colleague. Rabbi Goldman didn't tell you the whole story of how we came to this topic. He asked me to speak, and I was very honored and happy to do so. And he asked me on what I wanted to speak. I said, how about sex? And he said, that's taken already. And I said, well, how about relationships? He said, that's taken already. So I said, well, what else would people come to listen to? But in a sense, thanks for arranging it so that those two topics are already dealt with and I can do something different for a change, which is really nice. And we're going to look at a really important question. And it's not an important question not just because of Jewish pride and because of Jewish identity. There's some practical implications to the answers to this question. So be ready for that. The easy part is the answer. Are Jews really so clever? The answer is there is no evidence that they are. There is no scientific evidence that we have a higher IQ than anybody else. If anything, there might be evidence that there are other nations that have higher IQs than ours. So if we think we can sit back on our laurels and we just happen to be clever and bright and we've got this Jewish gene and that's how it is, that isn't so at all, and I'll show you some research that expresses concern about whether Jews will retain the high level of contribution they've made to the sciences and other areas of human endeavor. What's strange is, if there is no evidence of a Jewish gene of intelligence, our brains aren't different from anybody else's brains, there's no physiological basis to assume that there's anything about our physiology that makes us different, why are we so astonishingly successful considering our numbers of people? Now, I've anecdotally asked people in South Africa, and I've done the same in the United States, but will interest you with in South Africa, educated people, PhDs, business leaders, how many Jews they think there are in South Africa. And if you haven't had that experience of asking people that question, give yourself a treat and ask the question. The answers I got were all within the range of 3.5 to 5 million. Go and figure that out. Intelligent, educated people is estimating 3.5 to 5 million Jews in South Africa. How many white people are there in South Africa? 4 million. Oh, so we're kind of 25% more than the total white population. I don't know how it works. But it gives you an idea of the impact of the Jewish community on people's life and its visibility in terms of contribution. What they're saying is, if you look at the numbers, what they would be saying is then that the Jews as a community in South Africa are contributing much more than anybody else. When I ask them how many Jews they think there are in the United States, the number is between 25 and 40 million. That's true. So when we say we lost 6 million in the war, one doesn't wonder why they don't do anything more than say, oh, shame. They don't realize 6 million is 50% of the current population. It's huge. They think our population is massive. 40 million in America, 5 million here, who knows how many million in Europe. China's probably crawling with Jews. Who knows what they think? Out of the 12 people who got Nobel Prizes last year, 6 were Jewish. More than 20% of all Nobel Prizes have been won by Jews. I don't think anybody can accuse the Nobel Commission of being pro-Jewish. And yet Jews constitute 1.74% of the American population. So if you want to say of the highly educated society, we're only 1.74% and less than 0.2% of the world population. So now I say to you, there is no evidence of anything physiologically indicative of Jewish intelligence. And yet, and we're just taking Nobel because it's a kind of a public number. There are all sorts of measures you could use. Literacy, a number of people with PhDs and authors of books. There are many, many different measures and indicators you can use for Jewish intelligence. But none of them can answer or explain the reverse correlation between the contribution the Jews have made in any sphere and the very small percentage of the population that Jews are, in fact. I was interested to find out how scientists who are not pro-Jewish explain this. What would a Richard Dawkins say? If one said to him, Richard, Dr. Dawkins, professor, why do you think six out of the 12 recipients of the Nobel Prize were Jewish? Why do you think 20%, in excess of 20% of all Nobel Prizes have gone to Jewish recipients? How do you explain that? I don't know, he said, but I don't think it's a minor thing. It is colossal. That's what Richard Dawkins said. It's a puzzle. Can't figure it out. There is no scientific explanation for it. So what is it about? What is it about the Jewish people? And it's interesting because this leads right into perhaps the most important Jewish question of our time. The question that many, many American Jews are asking, and particularly young American Jews, and I understand that many South African Jews are asking this question as well, is why should I be Jewish nowadays? What does Judaism give me? What does it do for me that I couldn't get from living a good, upright, prosperous, contributive, educated life in one of the first world countries of the world? And being able to answer this question is quite important and quite critical. So if we say there's nothing genetic that makes us clever, there's nothing genetic that can explain Jewish success, then scientists started looking at various extrinsic reasons. Nothing intrinsic. We've studied the Jewish brain, we've studied other brains, nothing special about the Jewish brain. So it's not intrinsic. So let's look at extrinsic factors. So you've got the sociologists who look at issues around anti-Semitism. And maybe that's been the drive. That wherever we go, we face anti-Semitism. There's discrimination, there are difficulties for us to do anything unless we really do it ourselves, which is quite interesting. So for Jews, we would say discrimination causes us to become super successful, and for other minorities, we say discrimination needs affirmative action. How do you explain that? If discrimination is the reason, then either all the discriminated nations should be super successful, or none of them should be super successful. So it's difficult to accept the sociological reasons that are given for Jewish success. The public policy people say it's because of our dedication to education. And maybe that has something to do with it. And just now there's a psychologist by the name of Amy Chua who wrote a book called The Triple Package. And she says it's not only Jews who are successful, she's looking at life in the United States, but Jews and six other cultural groups are superior when it comes to succeeding in America. She was castigated by Time magazine only a few weeks ago for being racist by even talking about such things. But she says the fact is there's seven cultures that are particularly successful in the United States. There are a number of other cultures who are particularly unsuccessful, and everybody else is somewhere in the middle. And she analyzes what she calls the factors of success, and she refers to it as the title of her book as the triple package. Cultures, nations, ethnicities that have three qualities become super successful in the United States, and these are the three qualities. The first is a superiority complex. The second is insecurity. And the third is impulse control. Self-discipline, the ability to postpone gratification. Those are the three common traits of the ethnicities and cultures that are super successful in the United States. They have a superiority complex, they're insecure, and they have impulse control. The difficulty with that is it's very extrinsic. And if it's true, we've got to recognize that it's certainly not something exclusive to us. She herself counts six other cultures that have that too. And more importantly, it's not something we can necessarily retain. Are we always going to have superiority complexes? Are we always going to have insecurity? Are we also always going to have impulse control? Are we raising children with impulse control? Is that part of the discipline? Is that part of the child-raising technique of Jewish families, of Jewish parenting at the moment? I don't see a lot of it, of impulse control. Does that mean in a generation we're going to wipe out the competitive edge of the Jewish people? Well, according to Amy Chua, possibly so. But what I want to suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, is that the fact that it isn't scientific, this differentiation, this which makes us distinct, the fact that it's not scientific doesn't mean it's not intrinsic. We have a fairly narrow view of these things, and we think if it's intrinsic, we should be able to see it under a microscope. And if we can't see it under a microscope and we can't measure it, it must be some external force. It must be extrinsic to the Jewish to Jewish nature. But I would suggest, in fact, that it is intrinsic. Sorry, just the point over here, as I said to you, a view of researchers, Noah Ephron has done a lot of work in this area, and suggests there is no good reason to expect that the remarkable contribution of Jews to science will continue for generations to come. Don't take it for granted. And in terms of, if we go along the line of Amy Chua and other proponents of external reasons for Jewish success, that's clearly so. We could lose those. Whatever those external sources, anti-Semitism, whatever you want to say, we could lose that edge. And Ephron says, there's no reason to assume that the success that we've had over the years will continue indefinitely. We need to do something to preserve that. And this is really core to my message to you this evening, ladies and gentlemen. We'll discover what it is, in my opinion anyway, that distinguishes us. But it's not something that will survive without nurturing. We will lose it. And as my great uncle Reb Elie Lopin used to say, is with every part of the world, of nature, the higher the potential, the lower the fall when the potential is lost. And he used to say, when a piece of inorganic material ceases to exist, nothing happens. It's enhanced, if anything. Organic material, a plant dies, it decays. An animal dies, we're going up the ladder. It's more unpleasant. The decay is more unpleasant. There's a smell, there's a stench. When a human being dies and the body decays, it's much worse than an animal's. And he says, because the Jew has such spiritual potential, when the Jew loses his or her edge and decays his or her Jewishness, he becomes far more grob, far worse than any non-Jew. So when we talk about losing our edge doesn't mean we'll cease to be, you know, we won't be getting Nobel Prizes anymore. When Jews lose their edge, they're not pleasant people. Nothing to be proud of what we are when we've lost our Jewishness, when we've lost that which keeps us special. So if we're interested in the future of the Jewish people, not just as a race that survives, but as a race that makes incredible contribution to the world, we owe it to ourselves and to our nation to find out what the cause, what the root cause of that excellence has been, and to make sure that our children get it, and their children, and their children's children, and that we preserve that. It's not sufficient to preserve our survival. We need to preserve our capacity to make a difference. We need to preserve our ability to make a contribution. And when we say in the Havdalah every Saturday night, Hamavdil ben Kodesh l'chol ben Or l'choshech ben Yisrael l'amim, God who separates, who divides between the holy and the secular, darkness and light, the Jewish people and the other nations of the world, that word Mavdil is very important. That word Mavdil doesn't just mean separation. Mavdil means distinguishes. And there's a very big difference between separation and distinction, between difference and distinction. We speak about difference. We speak about separation. We speak about insulation. None of those words are the appropriate words. We've got to use a different word, and the word is, what distinguishes the Jewish person? What is Jewish distinction, not what is Jewish difference? And this is an idea that we're using in our work in business around the world as well. Because in business too, we've reached a time where the whole idea of competitive advantage is dead. The idea that I can rely on the fact that I do something different, what I do, others don't do. Those days are over. There's nothing you do that others don't do. There's nothing you do that others can't do cheaper. And you just Google the product and you find someone somewhere who can offer it quicker and cheaper and probably better than you can. The whole idea of competitive advantage doesn't exist. And if we think the Jewish difference is rooted in anything extrinsic, of course we'll lose it. Why should we preserve it? What would cause us to preserve it? But if we think in terms of Jewish distinction, then we can direct our thinking into a different process. The important part about Jewish distinction, if you can read, the screen's not very bright, but if you can read on the screen, I'll read it for you. The dictionary definition of distinction is something that is recognizably different in nature from something else of a similar type. What is there about the Jewish nature that is different is what we've got to ask. Not the Jewish brain cell, not the Jewish physiology. What is it about Jewish nature? And when we talk about Jewish nature, we talk about Jewish character. What are the characteristics that make us different? And I would suggest that there are three characteristics that distinguish the Jew, not differentiate the Jew, not separate the Jew. Doesn't mean that other people don't have these characteristics. But these are three characteristics that are core to our nature. We're raised with them. We've been raised with them for hundreds of years. For thousands of years we've been raised with them. And I would say the first one is the need to serve. Right in the very beginning, Adam and Eve are put in the Garden of Eden. What was their role? What was man created for? If you want to know what is the purpose of the creation of the human being, you look in Bereshit, when man was first created. And what does the Torah tell us? Man was put in the Garden of Eden, la'ovda u'lashomra, to serve it and protect it. And we don't know, there's a lot of discussion among the rabbis and the Talmud as to what they're meant to preserve and serve. Is it the garden? Is it each other? Is it God? Is it their soul? Is it the Torah? And the answer for the purposes of our discussion tonight is, it doesn't matter what it is. The point is, you've got to serve. A Jew has to serve. And by serve, I don't mean as a slave. By serve, I mean to serve a cause higher than you. To serve a cause that is meaningful. To serve a cause that matters. Jews need to serve causes. When a Jew doesn't serve a cause, he's frustrated. When a Jew doesn't serve a cause, he becomes psychotic. A Jew needs to direct all the complexity of his being to dedicate himself for something bigger than him. And that's why I would suggest Jews have been at the forefront of so many of the world's big movements, positively and negatively. Because they need to catch on to something big, and if they don't have it in their own religion, because they've become distant or alienated from it, they find something else to serve. But when Jews aren't serving, they become arrogant, they become complacent, and people don't like them. They're not nice people when they're not serving. We've got to look at ourselves in the mirror. We're amazing when we're serving. Look at this community and what it's built. Look at its institutions. Look at the people who built it, the people who came out of this country. What did they come with? Shuls they built, mikvahs they built, Talmud Torahs they built. rabbis they brought out, old age home, chevre kedishas. And these institutions exist until today and are among the finest in the world. The schools that have been built here. The South African Jewish community, more than any, knows what it is to serve, a small little community, steeped in service, because service is part of Jewish nature. We serve. We don't serve at the table, we do that too, but we serve an idea. We serve God, we serve the Torah, we serve the Jewish nation, we serve Israel. How else do you explain, other than by miracle, the arousal of the state of Israel so shortly after the near destruction of the entire nation in the Second World War? Because we had to have something to serve and believe in and build and create and make a difference. We can't exist if we're not serving. And the second is, we need to be dissatisfied with the status quo. It's just a need. I had the good fortune of listening to Ron Prosser, who's the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, a delightful speaker, addressing a group in Los Angeles only a few weeks ago. And he talked about how President Peres called him up just before he took his new position and said, "Don't forget to give the Jewish message to the world. Don't forget to tell the world what the Jews have contributed to the world." And knowing Shimon Peres, Ron Prosser is waiting for the punchline, because it doesn't obviously have a simple meaning. And there's a moment of silence. He says, "Jews have taught the world the art of perpetual dissatisfaction." Ron, when have you ever met a satisfied Jew? And he's right. Ohev kesef lo yispa kesef, ohev Torah lo yispa kesef. We have an insatiability. We cannot be satiated by the material, because we're designed to serve the spiritual. We're designed to serve the infinite. What finite thing could possibly satiate us when we're built with souls for the infinite? Now, you can put our brains under the microscope, you won't find a gene that tells you that, because that's in our soul, it's in our nature. But scientists don't concern themselves with such trivialities as souls, because you can't see them. But that's where the difference is. That's where the distinction is. We're distinguished by our need to serve something greater than us, to serve the infinite. And because we're designed to serve the infinite, we need to be dissatisfied with anything but perfection, with anything but completion, with anything but the infinite. Nothing but God and the Torah, in its biggest sense of the word, has the capacity to satisfy the curiosity and craving of the Jewish soul. And so we continuously search and seek and quest for break new barriers, cross new boundaries, to try and find something that will satisfy us. But we can only be satisfied by the infinite, and will never be satisfied by the status quo. Because by definition, the infinite is never status quo. The status quo cannot be spiritual. Status quo cannot be infinite. Infinite means you're not satisfied with the status quo. And the third thing is our need to question. Our need to question everything and everyone, including God Himself. There's nobody who escapes our need to question. And it's not trivial questions. We ask deep philosophic questions. We don't get answers. We don't need answers. We need questions. The whole Pesach Seder is built on four questions. Is there an answer? Isn't there? It's not very obvious where the answer is to the four questions in the Haggadah. The questions are what are important, because the questions define the insatiability. The questions define the dissatisfaction with the status quo. And so we question and question. We were doing some work with the Raytheon Missile Company in the United States. And we were, very strange work it was, we were teaching them how to sell missiles. Would you believe it? Two South Africans teaching Raytheon missiles, using Torah as the basis, how to sell missiles to different countries around the world. It's true. True story. Only 2 years ago. And it was interesting, the one country they didn't ask us to help them with was Israel. And we know, of course, they're very active in their business with Israel. But afterwards, they cornered me and took me to the side and they said, do you mind if we ask you a question about Israel? And I said, no, sure, go ahead. They said, why, no matter what we tell them, do they always question us? Why will they not take anything at face value? And I said, you're in good company. They question God too. That's who we are. We question. We're trained from childhood to question. The Gemara is question after question after question. Some questions have answers, some don't. And then you learn the Tosfot on the side of the Gemara and it's question, question, question. And you go into the Rashba, you go into the Ramban or any of the class, it's questions, questions. We're taught to question. Because our wisdom lies in the questions we ask, much more than in the answers we give. When you've asked the right question, anybody can give the answer. It's to know what question to ask. And from childhood we're taught to question. Because in order to be dissatisfied with the status quo, you have to know the art of questioning. In order to serve something greater, you've got to be dissatisfied with the status quo. These three characteristics are all connected. To serve something greater, you've got to be dissatisfied with what you currently serve. To be dissatisfied, you've got to question what you've currently got. Those are three characteristics that distinguish the Jewish people. But I'm going to suggest that that's not the whole story either. It's a nice idea, and I think it's true. But I think there's something much more important and much more exciting about what distinguishes the Jewish people. But to do that, I've got to ask you to change a paradigm. I've got to ask you to think of the word modernity differently from the way you probably do. And from the way I did before I started thinking about it. There are many definitions in the dictionaries for the word modernity. But one of the definitions is ahead of your time. You're modern when you're ahead of your time. What I'm asking you to think differently about the word modernity is, if the definition is you're ahead of your time, then is it possible that somebody 100 years ago was a modernist? So you would say, absolutely, in his time he was a modernist. I want you to go a step further than that and say, no, although he died 100 years ago, he's still a modernist today. Can you go that far with me? Normally we think of modern, it's current, something you read in the newspaper today, something just happened. And I'm saying not necessarily. Something might have happened 500 years ago that is ahead of its time now. Then it would be modern. It doesn't matter that it's old. Don't separate modernity or don't confuse modernity with age. You can have old people who are very modern. You can have young people who are very kind of last century. You can have people from previous generations who are very, very modern. You'll often hear people say the Rambam is modern. There's something modern about the way he thinks, about the way he classifies ideas. There's something modern about it. I want to say the Jewish people have perfected modernity and practiced it for 3,000 years. I want to say that Judaism is only now coming into its own. That it almost looks, if I didn't know the history of the Torah, I would say it was designed by somebody current for our generation. It is hard for me to think about Judaism. As I study it now and I'm aware of what's happening in the world, it's hard for me to think that Judaism was around, the Torah was around 500 years ago. Who needed it? 100 years ago. 50 years ago. The Torah was designed for now. And we've been living in this modern age for 3,000 years. That sounds like a bit of a sell, but I'll show it to you. It's true. If we understand what modernity is and what our current age is, and we understand the innovation of Avraham Avinu, of Abraham, you will see that Abraham was the first modernist, and he innovated modernism. He innovated the modernism that we use today and need today. And for 3,000 years, people have laughed at Jews and mocked Jews. Why? Because we've been 3,000 years ahead of our time. It's ridiculous. Imagine somebody today doing something that will only come to be in 1,000 years' time or 500 years' time. We would say they're crazy. People said Jews were crazy. Because we were doing things that only begin to make sense now. They didn't make sense then. And I'll give you examples. The rabbi of Kovna, quite a long time before the Second World War, was Reb Yitzchak Elchanan. Reb Yitzchak Elchanan was just an amazing human being, an incredible brain, an amazing soul, an incredible person, a very great leader. In those days, there wasn't photography as there is today, so you didn't see photographs of people. They weren't, if you heard with a newspaper article, they would write about them. There wasn't internet, there weren't photographs. So the Maskilim of the time, the Maskilim were the secular Jews of the time. They had drifted away from ancient Judaism, which they thought was no longer relevant. And they wanted to be modern and go to university and study the sciences. And so you had this whole group. Many of them came to South Africa. Many of them are possibly the forefathers of some of the people here, were Maskilim, intelligent intellectuals who found the expression of their intellect in secular wisdom outside of Jewish wisdom and very often outside of Jewish practice. And they heard about Reb Yitzchak Elchanan, the new rabbi of Kovna, and they heard of some of the statements he's made and some of his writings, and they said, at last, Kovna, the capital of Lithuania, has appointed a chief rabbi who's modern, a chief rabbi who understands the secular world. And they went off to Kovna to visit Reb Yitzchak Elchanan and to make friends with him and to invite him to their functions. He opens the door to them and he's got a long black coat and a long beard and a big black hat. He's a true Haredi. And they're completely taken aback. And he notices and he has them sit down and he offers them a glass of tea. And he says, why are you so taken aback? They said, we thought you were modern. And he said, what do you consider modern or not modern? They said, well, we're atheists. We don't believe in God. That's modern. This God stuff, that's ancient. And we thought you were one of us. He says, I said, I'm much more modern than you. And he quoted a passage from the Haggadah that we say every year. Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah hayu avotenu. In the olden days before Abraham, our forefathers were atheists. Until Avraham came in and introduced the modern idea of monotheism. I'm the modern, said Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. You're old time. You're still stuck in atheism. You're pre-Abrahamic. You haven't moved with the times one little bit. You're thousands of years behind the times. Now, what does that all mean? We don't have time to go into a full analysis of this, but I'm going to give you a little insight into what Avraham innovated. In the secular world, in the non-Abrahamic world. So I would argue that the secular world today, by secular I mean the secular, everything that is non-religious, of any religion, not necessarily ours, secular, sees the world systemically. And the more sophisticated the discipline, the more systemic it sees the world. There are many different systems. There are ecological systems. There are physiological systems. There are physics systems. There are chemical systems. There are economic systems. There are psychological systems. There are many different systems. And these systems interrelate with each other in certain ways. But if you want to understand a system, you have to be specialized in that system. Avraham taught that the universe is organic. It's not a system. There's a very big difference between organic and systemic. Organic has one initiator. Systemic has many. That's why the world was pagan. We think of pagan and we think of these ancient things and Greek gods. No. Pagan just means systemic. Different systems with different initiators, different disciplines, different ways of thinking, different powers and forces that interact with one another. That, said Rabbi Yitzchak Aharon, was the ancient way of thinking, systemic thinking. The way we think in secular science today, I'm not trashing science at all, of course, or any form of secular knowledge, but the approach to global knowledge, the approach to knowledge with a capital K, is not systemic, says Avraham, it's organic. It starts with a center, and it grows from the center in all different directions like a sphere, and it expands and expands and expands. And you can take any point on the outer circumference of the universe, and you can track its origin to the same place as the center point of that universe. Because it's one organism. And it doesn't matter whether it's an animal or a plant or a mineral or different human beings, it's one organism. That's the idea of the oneness of God. One creator, one God, one force. Sure, they have many different functions and they're designed in different ways and they are subsystems. But to understand that the universe is organic, not systemic. Ladies and gentlemen, the secular world is just beginning to get there. To Jews, it's been natural. Every cheder child has known that for thousands of years. That's how things work. And that there is correlation between the different systems. And there is one initiation of all the systems. And there's an overarching purpose and there's a direction. Jews have been preoccupied with the health of the soul. Because Jews have understood that if the soul is healthy, it's much easier to keep the body healthy. You've got to look after the body too. The body is a system, but it's organic. There's a connection between the soul and the body. And spiritual hygiene and spiritual fitness is as important as physical. Jews have had gyms for the soul. Do you know that? You can go to spiritual gym and exercise your soul. The exercises are not always easy. But you have to do it every day, just like gym. And when you don't do it for a few days, you get spiritually flabby and you feel it. Jewish gym or our mitzvot, those are the exercises. And the study of Torah. They exercise the soul. They don't do much for the body. Kashrut is not for cleanliness. Kashrut is for what it does to the soul. Yes, if the soul is well exercised, if the soul is trim and fit, that has all sorts of manifestations in the body because it's one organism. And Chinese medicine knew that. And now the West has woken up to the power of Chinese medicine. As if this is something radically new and the West never knew about it. One nation in the West has known about it all the time. They're called Jews. But they were thought to be a little odd. Talking about spiritual gyms. What does that mean? And the soul has different parts that relate to every part of the body, and there are exercises for every spiritual muscle. Did you know that? Each mitzvah works a certain muscle group of the soul. And we've been working our souls for 3,000 years. There is an organization called the Royal Society for the Arts, Manufacturing and Economics, I think it's called, RSA. And they're hosting an intriguing person as their guest of honor next month. His name is Ian McGilchrist. Ian McGilchrist is a person who understands that knowledge is organic. He qualified in English literature, became an outstanding Shakespeare scholar, went on to study philosophy, taught English literature and philosophy in Oxford and Cambridge, and then became a doctor, went to study medicine, and then became a psychiatrist. And today is a very influential psychiatrist in London who's written some amazing books. Do you know what the title of his talk is going to be? The State of the Soul. What's happened? We used to care about souls. What is the current state of the soul? In education, in business, in politics, in family life. Can we measure the health of the soul? And everybody's saying, wow, new age thinking. Yes, 3,000 years new. We've been talking about the health of the soul for 3,000 years. That's Jewish distinction. The fact that we're so rooted in modernity. Ladies and gentlemen, I used to admire people who kept Shabbos. Obviously, I was fortunate enough to be raised keeping Shabbos, but I always admired people who kept Shabbos. Incredible sacrifice. I don't anymore. I don't admire people who keep Shabbos at all. I deeply admire the people who don't. How do you stay sane in a life like ours without one day a week of detachment from technology? How do you do it? How do you keep your families together when they can't even talk to each other, they text each other? How do you keep them speaking to each other? How do you make sure that siblings really know each other and have deep conversations with each other? How do you keep families involved in the soul and in the spirit and connected to their Jewishness? You can do all of that without Shabbos? Unbelievable. It's incredible. I don't understand how. Because Shabbos was designed for now. We didn't need Shabbos before. We kept Shabbos before. But if I can be so controversial, although you've had your share of controversy already. If I could be so controversial as to say, until now, Shabbos was a nuisance. All the things you can't do on Shabbos. Now in the United States, people are paying $10,000 a head for a few days of Shabbos, meaning detachment from technology. Because people are addicted to technology. The degree to which the chief rabbi's initiative of the Shabbos campaign took off and the way it captured the imagination of people is not because of the sanctity of Shabbos. People just realized, like, you need this. How do you manage without this? And Eastern philosophy has known it for thousands of years too. They don't have a Shabbos, but they recommend one day a week of meditation where you don't drive, you don't go far, you don't cook, you don't write, you don't use technology. They've had that for thousands of years too. It's only in the West that we've looked at people who keep Shabbos as old-fashioned. Says Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, no. These are the modernists, the people who understand that you become distracted, you become ADD, you will become inefficient and ineffective if you don't take time out for yourself and for your family. And time out means 25 hours. And time out means during that time you turned off your business, you turned off your entertainment, you turned off your technology. How did you explain Shabbos? How did you sell Shabbos to people who were struggling to earn a living and needed that day? How did you used to explain Shabbos to people who weren't that distracted? There wasn't technology. They would use Shabbos as the one time they could watch television or the equivalent of it. Very hard to sell Shabbos. I've stopped selling Shabbos. Shabbos doesn't need to be sold. Not at all. We're living in a time where the modernity of the Shabbos concept has found its time, it's found its age. After 3,000 years of practicing it, we know how to turn off from technology because we've been doing it for 3,000 years. The rest of the world is beginning to struggle with it and are drowning and overwhelmed by the mere prospect of it. One can look at it not only religiously, one can look at it sociologically as well. This is some work done by a historian called Yuri Slezkin, who defines modernity and says modernity means people becoming urban, mobile, literate, articulate, intellectually intricate, physically fastidious, and occupationally flexible. That is what sociologically modernity means to Yuri Slezkin. It's the transformation of peasants and princes into merchants and replacing inherited privilege with acquired prestige. In the ancient days, people were peasants or princes, born that way and stayed that way. And in modernity, people become merchants and they are able to acquire prestige. You can buy prestige, work hard, make money, get your name all over the place, and you've got prestige, which in the old days you couldn't get unless you were born with it. We can buy prestige. That's modernity. Modernization, in other words, says Yuri Slezkin, is about everyone becoming Jewish, because we've been living that way for 3,000 years. So I'm not the only person arguing that Judaism has found its time. This is the time. We've been living a modern life in an ancient world, and we've been anachronisms. Not because we're old-fashioned. We've been anachronisms because we're ahead of our times. We're modern. For the first time, the practice of Judaism is incredibly relevant. But it goes one step further, if I may take another few minutes of your time. Our real secret weapon is not Shabbos only, although that is one. But other people are learning how to do it. Our real secret weapon is not only our need to serve and to question and to be dissatisfied with the status quo. Our real secret weapon, I argue, is the Talmud. The Koreans are right. And you might have been aware, the beginning of last year, a new Israeli member of the Knesset, Ruth Calderon, was honored with giving her maiden speech to open that session of the Knesset. And Ruth Calderon is not religious at all, and she makes it very clear in her speech that she is not religious, did not come from a religious home, had never seen any religious text as a child when she grew up. And she's still not religious at all. But she studies the Daf Yomi. She has a shas. When she came into her new office in the Knesset, she had to have them bring in a special bookcase because there was nowhere she could put her shas. Her set of Talmud couldn't fit in. This woman who is not religious at all. I'm convinced, she said in her speech, that studying the great works of Hebrew and Jewish culture, she means the Talmud, as she explains in her speech, are crucial to construct a new Hebrew culture for Israel. We will not be able to retain our identity without the Talmud, because that's where our history lies. That's where our culture lies. That's where our power of distinction lies. It's in the Talmud we learn how to question. It's in the Talmud we learn how to be dissatisfied with the status quo. It's in the Talmud we learn how to serve and make a difference. Nobody took the Talmud from us, says Ruth Calderoni, member of the Knesset. We gave it away. The time has come to reappropriate what is ours, to delight in the cultural riches that wait for us, for our eyes, our imagination, our creativity. Jewish creativity is fired and sparked by the Talmud. Now, that doesn't mean somebody who doesn't study the Talmud isn't creative. It just means we have thousands of years of Talmudic study in our DNA. Can you see it under a microscope? No. There are many cultures that are particularly good at certain things because they've done it for so long. And you'll see, and I'll talk very briefly about work done by Mark Prensky and others to argue that children born in the internet age have brains that are wired neurologically differently from children born before the internet age. Our brains take the format of the kind of activities we engage in from a mental perspective, and Talmudic engagement breeds a certain style of thinking that sparks innovation. that causes one to question, that causes a rejection of a status quo and the search for something better, for something new, for something different. The Talmud teaches us and has taught us for thousands of years how to do that. And why is that? Because here's Mark Prinsky. He was the first. Many people have done work since him, but he started doing his work about 20 years ago. And he talks about digital natives. And he talks about the neuroplasticity and malleability of the human mind, that our mind changes neurologically, and he's a neuroscientist. The internet generation might have brains that are physiologically different from ours. And their difference are in three areas, and you'll see why these three areas are so important. Hypertext minds. The text links that we have on the internet, and you click and you go somewhere else, and you click and you go somewhere else. That's the way their mind operates. Interactivity. They learn through interactive engagement. And they have parallel rather than sequential cognitive processes. They don't go through 1 + 1 = 2. That's not how they think. They see the one and one simultaneously on top of each other and the two behind it. They don't go through sequential cognitive process. I remember asking a little child, do you know the alphabet already? I was talking about the English alphabet, not the Hebrew alphabet. And she said, the alphabet, why would I need to know the alphabet? And I said, well, you... And then I started struggling. You might want to, she said, you might want to what? I was going to say a telephone book, she wouldn't have known what I was talking about. A dictionary, they don't use it. They don't think sequentially. I don't need to know that B comes after A. Now, we might argue it's a good thing to know and also, but to cope with life, you don't need to know that. You don't need to know where in the alphabet B is. You just search for B and you find B. And so it is with the way we organize information now, and their brains start working that way. Why is this important? So this is the modern mind. The real modern mind, this is children of the ages of under 26 or 27, function this way with hypertext minds, interactivity, and parallel rather than sequential cognitive processes. That's how the Talmud is designed, with those three processes. You cannot study the Talmud. I'm talking about serious study. I'm not talking about skimming it. I'm not talking about being a passenger and listening to somebody else read or teach it. I'm talking about delving into it and acquiring the skills of Talmud. And the Daf Yomi, the process of learning a page a day, is a wonderful social phenomenon. It's incredible how many people are doing it. And wherever you go, it's like Rotary. You just go and there's a Daf Yomi shir, and you connect with everybody, and they're all learning the same thing. An incredible social phenomenon, but it doesn't have a whole lot to do with really understanding Talmud. Because you can't do a page in an hour. If you spend the whole day, you might manage a page in the day. And what methodology are you using? Hypertext minds, parallel process rather than sequential cognitive process. And it's interactive. You learn in Chavrusa. We've been doing that for 3,000 years. That's how we study. The internet is natural to us. Technology is natural to us. Our minds have always been wired that way. Take a look. That one page that I showed you, this page, which happens to be the first page of the Talmud, just took it out. Many little children, 12-year-olds, start learning this. What's in this page? And it's only the centerpiece, which is the Talmud. Those of you who are not familiar with it, this is the Talmud. That's all. That's Rashi, that's Tosfos, that's Rabbeinu Nissim Gaon, there are all sorts of other people around the side. That's the Talmud. It's a short paragraph. If you were to print it just as one paragraph, it's a short paragraph. If I were to teach this, and when I teach this, it would take 4 or 5 hours just to teach the basics. What themes are covered in that paragraph? I'll give you 10 themes. Time as a value, the meaning of time. A 12-year-old child grapples on the first page of Talmud with the meaning of time. Is time absolute? Is time relevant? Is it relative? Where does time fit in? What is our relationship to time? Does the day start in the nighttime or does the day start in the morning? Sunrise or sunset? What's the relationship between sunrise and sunset? How much time is there between sunrise and sunset? How does it change during the seasons and why? Every young child has been learning this for thousands of years. Time management, one of the themes. How to manage your time. How to be a non-judgmental parent, one of the themes. Visioning, how to vision. The history and culture and spiritual practice, how to bring it into your current life. The meaning of sacrifice in the widest sense of the word. Self-discipline. Setting goals and understanding limits. The structure of successful didactic conversation. How to structure a conversation that is successful in being able to teach and convey a message. Parallel rather than sequential cognitive processes. You see it all the time. You can't learn it or study it any other way. And a young 12-year-old has to grapple not only with those 10 themes in one paragraph, he's also got to understand their connection. What's the connection between those 10 themes? How do they fit together? And he becomes a little philosopher. And he goes deeper and deeper until he finds the common root of 10 themes that would be completely disconnected. Do you see the difference between systemic and organic thinking? Systemic thinking would say those are 10 different specialities. Why confuse the child in one page? What have they got to do with each other? And Avraham comes and says it's one organism. Knowledge is one organism. The Torah is one. The originator of it is one. And you need to understand the linkages. And those linkages are so important. The Talmud is a web of interconnected ideas and thoughts and commentaries. We have about 1 million links in the digital app. Talk about a hyperlinking and a hypertexting way of thinking, which the modern world has just discovered in the last 20 years. In the Talmud already, they're just beginning with it. 1 million hyperlinks in the Talmud app, in the Art Scroll Talmud app. But look at this, ladies and gentlemen. 15 million downloads of Talmudic tractates using the Art Scroll app launched in 2012. There have been 15 million tractates. People are learning Talmud. The secret is out. And it's not only Jews and it's not only Koreans. I'm told that one of Art Scroll's biggest customers, if not their biggest in the United States, are the Christian churches. I have on my Awakened site many Christians who study Talmud, go to Talmud classes, some in their churches, some go to rabbis and study Talmud. Everybody's studying Talmud except the Jews. Isn't that interesting? The world is intrigued with Talmud because they realize it's modernity. You've been sitting on this for thousands of years and you never told us. Well, you never wanted to hear, nor would you understand, be that as it may. But even now, and yes, it is true about the Koreans. I'll play you this clipping. You probably won't hear much of the sound. A lot of the sound is in Hebrew, but I'll tell you what's going on. It's Israeli television. And he's reporting about a crew of Koreans who came to research Talmud study in Israel. That's Ponovich Yeshiva. The Koreans wanted to understand how the yeshiva system works. And they interviewed people. Look at that. Because they figured out that what distinguishes the Jewish nature are the skills you learn in Talmud. And there's one thing that's really important about the Koreans. What they were researching was not just why we've won so many Nobel Prizes, but why we've managed to do so and remain humble. That was their key. To become excellent and arrogant is not what they wanted. They wanted to figure out what the key is to becoming excellent and remaining humble. And they believed it was the Talmud. And yes, the Talmud has been introduced into high school curricula in Korea. I'm not sure how widely and extensively, but if 15 million tractates have been downloaded of the ArtScroll app, how many people in this room have downloaded a tractate on the ArtScroll app? Me neither. Not one. We're not one. One. We have one there. Of the 15 million, we're not one. It's not Jews. Everybody else has got the secret. And we think the Jews are clever. We don't need Talmud. We got it in our brains. We don't, ladies and gentlemen. All we have is the Talmud. A few generations away from the Talmud, and there'll be nothing clever about us at all. And Ephron will be right, we won't be winning Nobel Prizes. Because that's what distinguishes us. The fact that in this room, I would hazard a guess that there's nobody here who is more than four generations away from a Talmudic scholar. But that will become five generations and six generations and seven and eight generations, and then it's gone. Unless the children have come back, as many of them are. And so we find the Christians are learning Talmud, and the Chinese are learning Talmud, and the Koreans are learning Talmud. How many people in this room have either been through the King David school system or have had children who've been through the King David school system? A good percentage. Of those who've been through the King David, and it's a wonderful school and it's done incredible things, and King David school kids all over the world are recognized as exceptional people, and I'm not criticizing it in any way, but how many of you learned to master Talmudic skills at the King David schools? Not one. We're investing millions and millions and millions of rands in an education that will not preserve our Jewishness, that will not preserve our edge, that will not preserve our excellence. What are we doing, ladies and gentlemen? Why are we doing this? Why are we investing money in teaching maths and science and Shakespeare and everything else, which you can learn, and you can learn on the internet, you don't need to even go to school for that? Why the Koreans are going to Ponavi's Yeshiva? Have we lost it? Are we out of our minds? And so my call to you is, we don't have much time. Get back to Gemara. And do it now. Find yourselves teachers. Get yourselves rabbis. Don't worry about your children learning Gemara. It's too late for them. They'll learn Gemara when they see you learning Gemara. If you teach them to learn Gemara, they'll teach their children and they'll teach their children, but nobody will learn. You start learning. And when your children say, "Why are you learning Gemara?" you say, "Because that's what gives Jewishness its distinctive edge. That's what makes us distinguished. That's what enables us to make a contribution. That's what enables us to live our Jewish responsibility. That is what Christians around the world are now studying. That's what Koreans are studying. Because there's no other study, there's no other discipline in the world that treats human knowledge organically. All other disciplines treat knowledge systemically. And you've got to choose the system in which you want to think. In the Gemara, on the first page, you can cover 10 topics, one from sociology, one from education, one from astronomy, one from religious practice, one from literature, one from history, in one page. Because we don't have sequential cognitive processes. We understand the nature of the organism. That was the modernity of Abraham, of Avraham. That's the modernity of the Jewish people. Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan is absolutely right. The ancients were secular. The modernists understand the power of the soul and the oneness of the organism. That is modernity. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is Jewish distinction. Thank you.